Welcome to That's Spooky. I'm Johnny.
And I'm Tyler.
And this is a weekly podcast that is one of the few queer things that has yet to been appropriated by Katy Perry.
Right, yeah.
But I'm sure someday it's coming.
Listen, Katy Perry, we know you're out there. We know you're just waiting.
Yeah, totally. Just lying in wait. Look, as long as you grant some access to the wig collection, we can talk.
Sure.
Yeah, I'll hold space for that. Anyway, put a pin in that. Speaking of wigs, though, do you want to talk spooky gay bullshit?
Yes, let's do it.
All right, Drag Race talk first. So, Drag Race All-Stars 5, episode 4.
Episode 5.
I'm learning to count. It was the snatch game.
It was the snatch game of love.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so they did like a dating game thing. They had celebrities come in. The drag queens had to impersonate celebrities who were contestants trying to win the hearts of Jeffrey Boyer Chapman and Tommy Dorfman.
Sure, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So, high points, low points.
Ooh, okay. Let's start with my high point. So, India Farah, she came walking in on this season with old school written across her back, and she brought the old school in this episode. And by that, I mean she brought the old school Drag Race drama.
She wanted to fight with everyone.
She did.
She was trying to bring up stuff that allegedly happened off camera. That was some season 2 shit right there.
Right? Yeah. Like, I don't think anything can happen off camera these days for Drag Race.
Not since Tyra and Tatiana allegedly fought off camera.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So we had a lot of she said, she said going on in the workroom during the deliberation, and it was the petty level of drama that I want from Drag Race, and that was absolutely my high point.
Totally. Who do you think lied, Alexis or India?
Oh, I think India lied.
Same. Yeah, that's the old school drama that we're here for.
Exactly. All right.
Well, I would say the my high point is the multi-layered Flava Flav that we got in the snatch game.
Yes.
Not to completely pivot from India, but we got to talk about that Flava Flav.
We really do.
So Shea Coulee performed as Flava Flav, but it was like this feminist, postmodern Flavor Flav.
Sure.
That was like self-aware. It was making comments about like chauvinism and like, yeah, I don't know. It was just really good.
It was really good.
I don't
know.
She was doing shit and it just worked. Like, I'm just applying words to it.
But
like, if you don't know what I'm talking about, just look up the clip on YouTube. It's comedy gold.
Yeah, it was really great. I mean, Flavor Flav is such a huge personality and somebody who's been kind of out of the limelight for quite a while now.
Yeah.
But Shea Coulee really brought Flava to the snatch game of love, because in my opinion, Shea Coulee is the total opposite of Flavor Flav.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. Like, they brought this whole kind of, like, I hate to say the word, but like a woke Flavor Flav, you know what I mean?
Sure.
Like, it was just funny. Anyway, that is my high point for the episode. Low points, I'll go first.
Okay.
All right, I would say that my low point was also in the snatch game of love. It was Miss Cracker's, I almost said Miss Cracker because I'm used to saying Flavor Flav. Drop the yeah. ERs. I'm cool. All right.
Right.
But Miss Cracker's Lady Gaga. Ooh. Why? Why do we think that it is a good decision to do Lady Gaga in the snatch game? No one has done it right.
No.
And that is not for the reason that it is just waiting to be done right. I think it's for the reason that it's just not the best character to do. Unless you are a really skilled comedian.
Right. Well, three strikes, you're out, because now we've had three people try to do Lady Gaga and three people fail, and different iterations of Lady Gaga as well, I might add.
Absolutely. But you know what? I think Nicole Byer on the Drag Her podcast was kind of talking about it. If you made it like an uber activist kind of thing, if it was almost like Lady Gaga being like, I've breastfed the entire gay community.
Yeah.
Or something. Or Nicole Byer was saying if she were to perform Lady Gaga. You know, just have a completely opposite visual, just playing like this heightened, like, you know what I mean? Like, just
totally, like Nicole Byer as Lady Gaga.
Yeah, you know, exactly. So if it was something like that, because she does an Emma Stone, that is to die for.
Really?
Oh, Nicole Byer does an amazing Emma Stone.
How?
Oh.
Where would you even begin?
You can find it, yeah. So that is my low point. How about you?
Okay, my low point is the twist.
Yeah.
I am scared about this twist, because if you don't know what the twist is, it's basically that RuPaul announced on this episode that if you are not the top queen of the week, you are up for elimination no matter how well you did.
Yeah, so welcome to the Wild West, baby. Anything goes, and that means that our front runners could potentially be out of the game if they do not win. And I'm kind of scared for Shea, because Shea won this week.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if she'll win next week.
Right, and they're really coming into the Final Four, so people are going to start playing dirty. And I also have to say, it was just really unfair because there was a very clear bottom two this episode.
Yeah.
Miss Cracker and Blair St. Clair.
But
I guess also India Farah playing Jeffree Star. I was going to say,
and Blair's runway definitely did pull them out of the bottom.
It's true,
so,
you're right.
Anyway, we shall see what'll happen in episode six, but there are only a few more to go, so hopefully nobody pulls the Padge.
Right, we shall see.
All right, well, now, a little bit deeper into Spooky Gate bullshit, we shall dive.
Yes, let's dive.
Oh my god, why am I all of a sudden talking like the fucking, what is that? The Jabberwocky?
Ooh, the Jabberwocky?
Yeah.
Oh, I know that. Why do I know that? What is that?
It's like a poem with a whole bunch of fake words in it.
Oh.
Yeah,
anyway. For some reason, I just imagined something from Star Wars, but that makes sense.
Sure, I'm also kind of speaking like Yoda, so it makes sense.
It's true.
Look, I see the wheel turning. The hamster may be dead, but the wheel is turning.
Yes.
I stole that from a stand-up comedian like way back in the 90s. I don't even know who. All right, so TikTok body discovery update.
Yes.
This one's coming at us from Megan, and they say that they live about 50 minutes away from where the suitcase was discovered by the teenagers who put the video out on TikTok a few weeks ago. So, anyway, turns out it's not just one body that was discovered in the suitcase, it's two bodies.
It's two.
I know. So, it is a couple. It was a 27-year-old male named Austin Wenner and a 35-year-old woman named Jessica Lewis. Currently, there's an active investigation to try to figure out what happened. There was a GoFundMe created by Jessica's family, just trying to create some reward money for anyone that could bring some tips forward that could help solve the case. But holy fuck.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the information that they did release, and they're not releasing much because, again, it's an active investigation, but it is definitely determined that they were shot.
Yeah.
And that was the cause of death. So there's definitely foul play. It's definitely a homicide. And our hearts really just go out to the families and the friends of the victims and also the people who discovered the human remains at the crime scene that is traumatizing. That will scar you from ever going to the beach ever again.
I would burn every bathing suit I have.
Right?
Yeah.
Pools for me.
Totally. Oh, completely. Good point.
Uh-huh.
All right. Well, yeah, no. And thank you for the update, Megan. If anybody else finds out anything about this case, please pass it on to us. We are going to try to keep abreast of it in the news.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because we're reporters and we're wearing our business shirts, but we're not wearing any pants because we're reporting from home.
Absolutely. We are baby reporters. All right. So that is all that I have for Spooky Gate bullshit this week. How about you?
That's
anything?
It for me, and I have no oopsie poopsies.
Oh, look at you. You know exactly where we're going.
All right.
Well, I just so happen to have two.
Okay.
Now, one was pointed out to us from Jeff on Instagram. It is about Marsha P. Johnson. Now, when I was doing Marsha P. Johnson's case, I was all rootin' tootin' and called them a Leo. Joke's on me. They are actually a Virgo.
Oh, wait. Yeah. I think I called them a Leo.
No, maybe.
Oh,
who
maybe
knows?
We both have to take amends for this.
You know what? I really don't care who's wrong. It doesn't really matter. But
right.
I do want to point that out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, I can punish both of us later if you'd like.
Okay, great.
Yeah, totally. I'm going to withhold your snack tonight.
Uh-oh.
No chips for you. All right, and my second oopsie poopsie of the day is about the Newfoundland mines. Now, nobody reached out to me about this, but when I was re-listening to the episode, I just kind of realized that I skirted over why the mines closed on Belle Island, and I almost made it sound as if it was completely closed because Newfoundland joined Canada, and that's not the case. Basically, what happened was that they found mineral deposits, they found iron ore deposits closer to the surface in other parts of Canada.
Uh-huh.
And because the mine wasn't owned by anybody that had stake in the land, it was a Nova Scotian company actually that owned, ran the mines.
Okay.
They just moved their entire operation to where these surface deposits of iron ore were discovered.
Oh.
So that's why the first mine closed, and that's what kind of brought on, the succession of closings over the next few years.
Right. So they were just this opportunist mining company that didn't give a shit about where they were.
Yeah.
They just wanted what they wanted.
And I guess it can also speak to a larger narrative about, interprovincial relationships and stuff like that. But that is another story for another day. I just kind of wanted to add a little bit more clarification to that.
Totally.
Yeah. All right. So that's all that I have for oopsie poopsies. Now, housekeeping.
Mm-hmm.
This is fun. If you couldn't tell, which unless you're not subscribed to this podcast, you probably can tell. We started Queens of the North last weekend.
Yes, we did.
And now that the first episode's out, we are excited to announce that the next episode will be coming on Saturday, July 11th. Mm-hmm. Again, we are going to be releasing this every Saturday, this time a little bit closer to midnight. That's the exciting part.
Yes.
That's the housekeeping bit. And yeah, feel free to like boost it and, you know, like it. And if you are just coming to the podcast, welcome. Please subscribe. And if you've been here for a while and you're like, what the fuck is this, then it'll be over soon, babies.
Definitely, it's going to pop up in your feed, but you can just ignore it if you're not consuming Canada's Drag Race, because we're still going to be doing what we always do on Wednesdays.
Exactly. And if anything, we started Queens of the North so that we weren't filling this podcast up with Canada's Drag Race.
Right, because as you know, we have All Stars 5 happening right now. We didn't want to put a hat on a hat.
Well, no, and we're also really here to talk about spooky shit. We only talk about the drag stuff because it relates to the queer part of our mandate.
That's
But at the end of the day, we want to freak you out, which kind of perfectly segues into our next segment, the main event.
Yes.
Where I am starting us off, correct?
You are.
And I really wasn't lying when I said that we're here to freak you out. I'm very excited to present my topic for today because it's iconique.
Trey iconique.
Yeah, this is like the Cher of the paranormal world.
It is.
It's like one of the divas.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
So today, my friends, I'm going to be talking about a little known ghost story called the
Give it another take.
So today I can't even be cute about it. I'm talking about the fucking Amityville Horror.
Bitch.
Drop that mic. All right. So I hereby promise that that will not happen again.
Uh-huh.
I don't actually. No, I kind of do know what that was. I was just really building up to a moment. I got really excited and then the wrong word came and I just deflated.
And what was that word?
The Amityville Horror.
Right, okay, yeah.
There was no P in it whatsoever. But here we go. So the Amityville Horror is probably one of the most notable paranormal cases of the past century.
Oh yeah.
It's inspired a best-selling novel and inspired an iconic horror movie and a bunch of terrible sequels. And it also inspired generations of people to sleep with the lights on. So I'm sure everyone else has a touchstone for this story, and that is A-okay. This is not about splitting this fucker wide open. But when it comes to talking about these iconic cases, you know, like podcasters like us are really just throwing in our spin on things.
Totally.
So with that being said, I'm sure that there are a ton of little micro details that might get left out. And I'm not talking about big story stuff, but I know that my Amityville Horror and like the story from some people's perspectives has come out. And while I have watched those, while I have folded that in, what we are here to talk about today is the, you know, Amityville Horror proper, like the story that has been disseminated.
Yes, like the Pringles classic.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're going classic today. So let's start with the broad strokes of it all. Amityville is a town in Long Island that's in New York, and it's about 50 kilometers outside of New York City. And since the 1970s, the town has had a pretty steady population in the mid to high 9,000s.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Amityville itself is known as a pretty idyllic community. There's lots of water, you know, the Amityville River runs through it. And since the 70s, it has also developed a reputation for much more than its beautiful scenery.
Right.
Which is all thanks to the Amityville Horror. Bam, 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 bam. All right, so this all starts out in the summer of 1975. In Amityville, when a couple by the name of George and Kathy Lutz are looking for a home. Now, the two of them are newlyweds. They are looking to essentially combine their households. The kids are all really Kathy's from a previous marriage, but George was previously married as well. In fact, the two of them were just recently divorced, from my understanding, but had just remarried with each other in 1975.
Okay, now did he have kids with from his other marriage?
I have no idea.
Right.
Yeah, I don't think so. They didn't come up in anything, but like today we are just talking about the five of them.
Right.
So that is Daniel, Christopher, Missy, those are the kids, and George and Kathy Lutz. So Over the summer months, George and Kathy looked at about 50 houses in total around the New York Amityville area, and one of them really caught their attention. Now, this house was at 112 Ocean Avenue in Amityville. It was a beautiful three-story Dutch colonial home. It was built in 1927. It was in a very nice neighborhood, and it had this like cute little wooden sign out front that said, High Hopes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I was very optimistic. Uh-huh. Now, the house itself had 5 bathrooms. No, it did not. It had 5 bedrooms, but it had 3.5 bathrooms, so almost 5.
That's still pretty good for bathroom numbers.
Still pretty luxury, mm-hmm. Yeah, but it also had a large finished basement, and it was a waterfront home with a back that opened up to the Amityville River. So there was a boathouse, there was a dock. It was super cute. And it was $88,000.
I mean, that sounds like a pretty good deal, even for 1970s standards.
Exactly. Now, this is the house that we have all come to know as the Amityville Horror House, and you can very easily Google this. This house also has a very, characteristic set of windows. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's these like 90-degree fan-shaped windows that are on the very top floor, which is kind of like the attic space, and they almost look like eyes.
Yes.
Yeah, so they're fanned out at a 90 degree, and then the flat sides are facing inward, almost creating the semblance of a nose. So it almost gives the house this, like, pig of hell kind of look with the shutters that go below it.
Totally. And I guess the windows being fan-shaped kind of makes it look like it has really big eyelashes, like some 301s are slapped on that house.
Sure, mm-hmm. yeah, totally. Like a very clowny demon. Yes. So this is the thing. For $88,000, this house was a steal, and it didn't really add up to the Lutzes when they got the rundown from the realtor, until the realtor opened up to them a little bit more about the home's history. Mm-hmm. So it turns out the house that George and Kathy Lutz were slowly falling in love with was not just home to one recent murder, but 6 recent murders. Aye. Yeah. So November 13th, 1974 was when all that went down. Now, on this night at around 3:15 a.m., 23-year-old Ronald Butch DeFeo Jr., Butch is his nickname, of course, he shot and killed 6 members of his family in that very home at 112 Ocean Avenue in Amityville. This is about 13 months before George and Kathy Lutz would be looking at the home.
Right. It's very Villisca axe murder sort of situation.
Yeah. Actually, no, it's not 13 months. Sorry, my math is a little bit off there. It's actually about, give or take, like it's 7-8 months or so.
Oh, shit.
Anyway, so basically, in November of 1974, Ronald DeFeo shot his father, Ronald Joseph Jr., or Sr., who was 43 years old, his mother, Louise DeFeo, who was 42 years old, and his siblings, Don DeFeo, who was 18, Allison DeFeo, who was 13, Mark DeFeo, who was 12, and John DeFeo, who was 9. Uh-huh. He shot his parents twice, and he shot his younger siblings once each. And like I said, this all happened around 3 in the morning. The entire family was asleep.
Right.
So Ronald DeFeo had basically just gone room to room committing these murders. And he then stayed in the house. He washed up. He essentially cleaned up, you know, the weapon, tried to drop it and stuff like that.
Okay.
And later on that day, so like we go into the afternoon, it is then 6:30 p.m. Ronald DeFeo goes to a local bar, and as he walks in, he just goes, I think something's up with my family, all that kind of stuff. And you know, a few patrons who were at the bar go down to the DeFeos to see what's going on. Now, as soon as they get to the home, they can tell that something's up, so the police get called down there, go inside, and very quickly discover the 6 bodies all in their beds. Aye. Soaked in blood. Yeah. So basically, the police start talking to Ronald DeFeo Jr. ASAP because he is the only surviving member of the household. Mm-hmm. And right away, he indicates that he thinks that the murder could have something to do with the mob. Like, he starts throwing the scent off.
Okay.
Yeah, basically kind of playing on the fact that his family was Italian. So, yeah, he was like, oh, I think that it might be some sort of mob hit that was out on my dad or something like that, or revenge that somebody was trying to get. Who knows? So the police take him into protective custody at the neighbor's. Mm-hmm. Then when his grandfather shows up to, you know, talk to the police and, you know, potentially, you know, be with Ronald and all that kind of stuff, the police hear the grandfather pull him aside and basically say, stop dragging our fucking family name through the mud with this mob bullshit. just admit to what you did, because we all know.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, so the police are kind of like, all right, well, we're going to go down to the police station. Maybe you should come with us. And Ronald DeFeo is just talking. Still saying, I don't know what's happening, but, you know, the police continue to interview him. And as they interview him, his story essentially just falls apart at the seams.
Right.
And it doesn't take long for the police to be able to get a full confession out of Ronald DeFeo Jr. And ultimately, he is taken to trial with 6 charges of second-degree murder. Now, when at trial, Ronald DeFeo Jr. tries to plead insanity by saying that the devil made him do it.
Okay.
He said that he was hearing voices, he was at the house, and he thought that he heard voices telling him that his family was conspiring against him, and then he thought that he could hear the family, but that maybe that was an implanted voice or something like that. And then a lady with black hands appeared in the living room to him while his family was sleeping and he was down there watching movies, and gave him a gun and told him, you know, basically, you know what you've got to do. So this is what he says at the trial. They don't believe him and they end up charging him.
Right.
Now, there's a lot to sink your teeth into with the Ronald DeFeo case, and I think that I should cover this someday because there is a whole lot more to this, honey.
Absolutely.
I am leaving out pages and pages of potential discussion. But that, like, this is more so a footnote in the Amityville case, but it's kind of required reading.
Definitely.
Yeah. And some of these things that I've said as we discuss Ronald DeFeo will come into play a little bit later. Like, basically, the TLDR of this all is that this guy killed his family in the house, tried to say that the devil made him do it.
Right. And that's what I was always familiar with. I was always familiar with him saying that the devil made him do it, but I did not know that mob angle.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Before he said that the devil made him do it at trial, he was trying to say that anybody else was making him do it.
Right.
Which also, to me, like, not to completely editorialize, but again, this will come into play, feels a little bit fishy. Like, it also just kind of feels like the, you know, the spooky ooky side of that murder that a lot of people tout was something that he just kind of came up with to throw off the scent of the trial.
Right, because he tried to be a wise guy by blaming the wise guys, and then he tried to blame it on the devil.
Exactly. So, that happened in the house. Months later, the Lutzes are looking at it, and you know what? At $88,000, they're just kind of like, well, I think we can deal with all that history.
Yeah.
In fact, they're so okay with it that not only is a deal struck up for the $88,000, but the Lutzes agree that if they are to buy the house, they're completely down to pay $400 to buy all the furniture from the DeFeos that was left in the house.
Oh.
Yeah.
Ooh. I mean, yeah. I don't know about that.
Well, yeah. So there was one catch, though. They had to talk about it with the kids. George and Kathy were just like, look, our kids are property moguls. They would just die if we didn't discuss this with them.
Totally.
So they, you know, take a moment. They walk away from the home. They sit down as a family. And the kids are basically like, wow, that is a steal of a mortgage, Dad. And in this economy, you should do it. Yeah, so the family buys the home and they are set to move in for December 18th of 1975. And really, the Lutzes are pretty damn happy with their decision.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Would you move into a house that was the scene of a terrible crime if the price was right?
I mean, sure.
Yeah.
If they did the right cleaning afterward.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. I wouldn't want to do the cleaning.
Okay, look, depends on the house, depends on the price, depends on the crime.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's kind of like the game that you have to play with this whole thing.
That is true.
Yeah.
It's a sliding scale.
Absolutely.
Yes.
So the Lutzes are feeling good. They've got a house on lock. It's full of furniture, which, you know, is a little bit questionable if you ask me, but they've got the new start that they're looking for. So everyone's on board. Now, they start moving in the month of December. They don't officially get in until December 18th of 1975. But according to George Lutz, shit started getting weird in the first hour.
Ooh, I mean, pro of that, at least you know what you're getting into. Con, not great.
Yeah.
Just really bad.
All right, so trigger warning. Shit with pets is coming up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the family was getting settled into the home. Everything is fine. Their family dog is chained up outside. And all of a sudden, they hear what I would probably consider one of the worst noises, which is a dog fighting for their life.
Mm-hmm.
Now, George runs out, and it turns out that the dog, who was chained up near the fence, tried to hop the fence for whatever reason. And, you know, George kind of commented that that kind of behavior was really out of the dog's character.
Sure.
But it had tried to jump over the fence and it was caught on the other side, dangling there a few feet off the ground. It was hanging itself.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So George thankfully is able to catch the dog before, you know, it's really harmed or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Gets them back inside and, you know, just kind of counts his blessings. But that is enough to kind of make George and Kathy go, oh, we need a little bit of backup in this situation. So after much thought, the two of them decide to have the house blessed by a Catholic priest.
Right.
Yeah. And you can tell they mean business because they're Methodist.
Yeah.
For real. So a Catholic priest named Father Ray comes to the house for a blessing. Now, the family was moving some more items in at the time, so George just kind of remembers waving to the priest as he kind of came in, and George was coming and going with the family.
Mm-hmm.
As the priest was leaving, though, George went to pay him for his services, and the priest really just would not take money for anything that just happened.
Right.
Which I'm not really that surprised by, but George was. So he asks, like, hey, well, why won't you take my money for blessing the house? The priest says, you don't charge for this, and you don't charge friends for this. And then he goes on to tell George that there was something really strange upstairs in the bedroom that the family was planning on using for a sewing room,
okay.
Thank God. But he says that as he was up there, he felt as though he had been slapped and heard somebody say, get out.
Oh, shit, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and on top of that, the priest reported that he was getting really just foreboding feelings throughout the house. So he tells George all of this, and George is pretty uneasy, but the priest basically just goes, you know what, that's okay, you're not gonna sleep in that room. As long as nobody is sleeping in the sewing room at any point, you're good.
Wow, that's like taping over a leak.
I know, yeah, and like, what a fucking bomb to drop as you are leaving the house. You're like, oh, you don't have to pay me because you're fucking haunted.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so anyway, undeterred by the disconcerting interaction with the priest, the Lutz family continues on. They are fully in the home on Ocean Avenue, and they're feeling good. But I'm going to preface this whole thing with one little fact.
Okay.
The Lutzes only stayed in the home for 28 days.
Oh.
Yeah. They Wait. Were driven out. Girl, don't act like you don't know the story.
No. I thought they were there a little bit longer than 28 days.
No. Like zombie movie shit, girl. So, or Sandra Bullock in that movie about rehab.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It just took them 28 days to quit ghosts. That's all.
You know what, though? When those zombie movies started coming out, I was a little bit confused. I was like, what does this have to do with the other one? I thought they had something to do with each other. Yeah.
I mean, that's the mashup I'm waiting for.
I'm that girl. All right. So there. I'm just going to put that there. Just keep that in the back of your mind as we move through this story. The family staying in the house thing, not the Sandra Bullock thing.
That's right.
So, anyway, the family is in the house. Shit's already going wrong with the dog and with the priest. And in not a lot of time, like within a matter of, you know, the first day or so, the family starts to feel cold spots throughout the home. And not just like, ooh, I think there's a window open kind of cold spots, like the ones that we've talked about before on here, where there's just a huge temperature drop that cannot be explained by anything in the physical world around you.
Right, not even mid-December.
Absolutely. So that's happening. And then every now and then, the family members would feel as if they were woken up in the night by a sound, but there was no sound. Like, you know when you are woken up by like a big crash or something like that, that kind of like startled feeling that you have, and that sensation of like hearing something, but you know how usually there's at least a little bit of hangover when you come into the waking world?
Right.
The family wasn't experiencing that.
So they had that feeling, but not the cause.
Exactly. So there was just a lot of effect without any cause happening, and this stuff was usually happening while the family was sleeping. So they just kind of clock this as weird. They're like, oh, maybe, you know, we're just getting settled in the home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe there's like a drafty draft in this, you know, creaky old home that we're in. It was made in the 1920s after all. Who knows?
Yeah.
But after a matter of days in the home, the members of the family started getting even more signs that something was off.
Okay.
And this was less group phenomenon by this point and a little bit more personal stuff. So at this point, like, everything kind of splinters off into individual experiences. And the thing about these individual experiences is that a lot of the time the family wasn't sharing this with each other until a little bit after the fact. So there was always this feeling feeling of shit happening to you, like if you were a family member, and then not wanting to tell anyone because you kind of felt like you would be considered wacky by everyone else.
Right.
If you catch my drift.
But everybody else is going through the same stuff.
Absolutely. Which, if you want to kind of look at it from a demonological standpoint, is, you know, this kind of malicious entity trying to corner people or right. trying to, you know, isolate people or get them on their own and get them scared.
Right, because they kind of feed off of that fear. If they feel like they're all in it together and they're not going through it alone, then that would probably take some of that fear fuel away.
Exactly. So, George started seeing a really weird pattern in the times that he would wake up when he was sleeping. He found himself waking up pretty consistently at around 3:15 a.m. every night. And when he would wake up, he would have a really weird compulsion to go to the boathouse.
Right. Well, 3:15, you know what we call that.
The boat time, of course.
That's it. It's boat time,
yeah,
baby.
Yeah, the docking hour.
Uh-huh. I mean, dead time. Yes.
Also the witching hour. Don't forget about the witching hour.
Oh, true. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was happening to him and he kind of found that it was a little bit odd. But after a few days of this, it really started to get in the way of George's sleep cycle. And that started to have a little bit of a physical toll on him. And maybe it was the lack of sleep or maybe it was something more. But as George's personality started to shift, you know, in the days following moving into the home, mm-hmm. it really started to seem almost as if he wasn't just like moody, but his personality was changing in
right.
a way. Yeah. His hygiene started to really fall by the wayside, which was something really uncharacteristic for him. Mm-hmm. And he always complained that he could never get warm. And Kathy found this really weird, and she always saw him outside chopping wood. Just, yeah, like he was obsessed with doing it because he always thought that he had to have the fires raging 24/7.
Yes, and now I think we all have flashes of James Brolin chopping that wood in the original movie. You really can't think of the Amityville without thinking of that movie.
That's true. Does the Supercut exist?
I don't know that it does.
It has to somewhere. I'm sure. You don't think just because you haven't seen it, but look, the internet.
It's true.
A wide expanse.
Right. Now, do you remember the 2005 remake?
Oh, yeah.
I'm pretty sure the only reason they remade that is so that they could have Ryan Reynolds shirtless the entire fucking time.
Totally. A bunch of executives were sitting around one day and they're like, what classic shirtless wood chopping scene can we get Ryan Reynolds to recreate?
That's it.
Oh, I'm sorry. It wasn't shirtless. I just imagine it that way.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, so George was always cold and he would always hear doors slamming and he would get mad at the family being like, stop slamming those doors. And they'd be like, we don't know what the fuck you're talking about, George.
Uh-huh.
And Kathy, she had her own host of problems. So like George was kind of the least of her worries. She's like, you can fuck off with your doors and your wood.
Right.
Because Kathy started to get this feeling like she was always being watched in the house.
Mm-hmm.
Like 24/7. And this soon developed into her feeling light touches whenever she'd be upstairs alone.
Yikes.
Yeah. And not just like little tippy tappies, but like unmistakable touches. And then one day it got really freaky. Kathy was upstairs folding laundry and she felt as though like a woman hugged her.
Ooh, like a pressure.
Yeah, and like a pressure with boobs. So Kathy tells George about this and he got really concerned as well. He had not been experiencing anything like this, but he also just had not been aware that Kathy had been going through it.
Right, because ghosts are one thing, but ghosts with boobs?
Mm-mm. Terrifying. Yeah, and then it gets really weird because one night Kathy woke up in the middle of the night, goes to the bathroom, looks in the mirror, and she doesn't see her own face in the mirror, but sees the face of a 90-year-old lady.
I mean, that is terrifying.
Yeah, and according to Kathy and George, it took hours for her face to go back to normal.
Like her actual face, yeah. Or just the face in the mirror?
Yeah, like I would have grabbed a camera.
Uh-huh, that would have been a great idea, or, you know, maybe adjust the lighting in the room.
Yeah, who knows? But yeah, according to them, like, her face just completely changed into, you know, somebody in a different time in a different place, and then it just went back to normal after a few hours before the kids woke up. Yeah, and then they also started to notice a lot of houseflies in the home, which seasonally was just a little bit weird, because this is December that we're talking about.
Right, December in, like, New York. New York, yeah.
Yeah, we don't know if it was, like, north of New York, south of New York City or whatever. But yeah, in New York State, which can get pretty damn cold. It mm-hmm. can get pretty Canadian there pretty quick.
It's true.
Yeah. So aside from all of that, George and Kathy could also swear that from time to time, they could see a man or just some figure walking around the home that was missing a chunk of their head.
fuck right off.
Yeah, like, they couldn't exactly figure out who it was, but they were just like, that's the form of a person missing the chunk of their head. And they would see it out of the corner of their eye, and then they would go to see what was there, and there was nothing.
Right. I mean, right away, knowing what had happened in the house, I would be jumping to conclusions.
Exactly. Now, that's George and Kathy. It does not take long as well for shit to start popping up individually for Missy. But for this, it's a little bit more innocent at first. So, after moving into the home and, you know, everyone starts experiencing the cold spots and the waking up and all that kind of stuff, before stuff really starts ramping up with George and Kathy, Missy starts developing a new invisible friend.
Okay, yeah. Right.
And this friend was named Jody. And I guess it was a pig?
Jody the pig.
Yeah.
Listen, I've known a few pigs named Jody in my life.
You know what? Listen to Spooky Snacks and you will hear me talk about one, actually. Yeah, so Missy gets this new imaginary friend named Jody the pig. The parents noticed this because essentially Missy just started talking to the air and they were kind of like, what's going on, buddy? Mm-hmm. And Missy explains it all to them. And then it turns from just an imaginary friend to an angel. Basically, Missy starts to be like, oh yeah, Jody's an angel and they live in my room. And Jody says that I'm going to be living here forever with them. Isn't that exciting?
Right.
Yeah.
Not
forever
at all.
Home. Yeah. So Jody's fully in like nesting mode Missy's fully in nesting mode with Jody.
Right. They're picking out wallpapers. They're, you know, doing feng shui, all that stuff.
Yeah. And according to Missy, like, you really want to talk about feng shui? Jody could change their form depending on, you know, what they want it to be. So depending on the mood, Jody could be whatever they want it to be. Depending on the room, Jody could always find a way to fit in.
Right.
Yeah. Jody worked with every decor. That's what you need to know. Now, this really kind of freaked George and Kathy out a little bit more than just a regular imaginary friend, probably because she called it an angel.
Sure.
Mm.
Yeah. A pig-faced angel. That's not... Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. You know that song, Pig-Faced Earth Angel? You know that old classic?
Totally. Buddy, yeah, Holly, I love it.
Exactly. So, yeah, Missy just, you know, kicking it with their friend of many faces, Jody. The parents are not loving it so much, especially when Missy shares with them that Jody. All the J names,
hey,
baby.
She goes by many names.
You know what? Many forms, many names. That's our friend Jody the pig angel.
Right.
But yeah, basically, Missy is laying this on George and Kathy. And when she starts talking about the forever home stuff, that's when the two of them start to be like, we really don't like this new friend that Missy's been hanging out with.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And then it gets even worse. Don't worry. Because as we remember in the movie, one night when Missy is being put to bed, George and Kathy are in there with her, and Missy is just like, oh my god, there's Jody. Mm-hmm. And she points out the window, and there is a set of red glowing fucking eyes in the window.
Right.
And Kathy are terrified. They get her out of the room. You know, George goes to see what it was. There's no sign of it. The red eyes ran away.
Mm-hmm. I don't think I could think of anything more terrifying than glowing eyes outside of your window. That was just like on Suspiria. Do you remember that? That was like the creepiest scene in that movie.
Oh, yeah. You know what could be more scary than that, though? Your toilet turning black.
I mean, yeah.
And I don't mean like the water. I mean the porcelain.
Oh, you know what, though? That would be cute.
Yeah.
I feel like it would be hard to clean, though. You wouldn't really know when it's fully clean. Just like black socks.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what, though? I'm sure university residences would definitely put black toilets in if they could.
Absolutely.
Because you know what? That's working in their favor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, back to the family. So their toilets are turning black and their daughter's friends with a pig-faced angel that really freaked them out one night.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the china started turning black at a certain point, too.
Oh.
Yeah. Which really just negates the whole, you know, holding onto the fine china for when the good company comes.
Totally. Well, you know, the Amityville house is just going through its gothic phase.
Truly. But it's also going through a bedwetting phase because it turns out that these weird random stains and like wet splotches started to show up on the floor and on furniture.
Ooh.
And George and Kathy just couldn't explain it, but they were just kind of like, well, I guess it's the house.
Right.
Yeah. And then the shit would like show up on walls. And according to George, he would find slime in the house.
Oh, like ectoplasm?
Yeah, kind of. And even worse than slime and wet spots, crucifixes would invert on their own from time to time in the house.
Of course they would. Yeah, why wouldn't
just
they?
To really seal the deal.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, this goes on for about 28 days. Like I said, you know, a lot of this is kind of fragmented. A lot of people aren't connecting their stories with each other right away. And the Lutzes are kind of wishy-washy as they recount things. They never really give a complete timeline. That's kind of why we're jumping around so much and just kind of talking about everyone's experiences one by one.
Sure.
Now, the two, you know, older boys in the family were also experiencing some weird stuff. They were hearing things in the house and all that, but nothing quite as dramatic as Missy, George, and Kathy.
Right.
Until the final night in the house. So after 27 days of weird shit happening at 112 Ocean Avenue, the family is going to bed. Mm-hmm. Now, this is the night of January 13th, 1976 into January 14th, 1976.
Was it a Friday?
I don't know.
Let's ask Rebecca Black. She'll know.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. So while I'm telling, you'll reach out to Rebecca Black. Totally. I really appreciate that. Well, the thing is, the family goes to bed. It's business as usual. But George recalls waking up and seeing Kathy, who was laying next to him, levitating in bed. Now, he says that he had seen this before, you know, her levitating, but this time she was levitating and moving slightly.
Ooh.
I love that the movement was the thing that got him.
Right.
He was like, well, I mean, 27 days in, like, this is old hat to me by now.
Right.
But basically, she, you know, like levitates up, shifts over to the side, and then George feels the distinct feeling of something getting into bed with them.
Ooh.
And absolutely terrifying, but he can't see this thing.
Sure.
But he also can't move. He is entirely paralyzed. Kathy is asleep, mm-hmm. now, you know, a little further away from him on the bed, and there's something between them. Then George hears commotion above him. It's the kids. Their beds are lifting up and down from the ground and just kind of rattling, and he can hear them kind of moving throughout the room.
Right.
And of course, George is paralyzed in bed with Kathy. Neither of them can go and help the kids or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So they hear that. They also hear pigeons fluttering all night, stuck in a vent over the bathroom, which, spoiler alert, they checked it out the next day. There was no sign of pigeons or anything like that, but just something created this sound of just like pigeons rattling in all of the vents around them at all times.
It's terrifying.
And George is experiencing most of this. Again, Kathy is asleep for this. But then the lights were flickering on and off on their own, and George said that the family dog was up in the room with them. It actually spent the night with them in the room.
Right.
But it would not sleep at all throughout the night. It was just walking in circles and vomiting.
Oh, no.
I know. And I mean, I hope they were cleaning it up as it were vomiting. But if not, just imagine shit going wild. You're paralyzed and there's dog vomit everywhere.
I mean, literally the worst night ever.
Absolutely. So that happens. And then the next morning, the family is able to connect and kind of communicate about things. Basically, the two older boys come downstairs and they corroborate what happened. They were in bed. That started moving. They weren't able to, you know, get out of bed or anything like that. They were all just kind of locked in place as this shit was happening.
Right.
So George was unable to get up as well. So whatever this was, you know, he was kind of like, great, now this is taking all of us down en masse. And Missy, who, you know, they hadn't connected with as all this was happening either, heard it all. And, you know, she was locked down in her bed as well as it was shaking around the room.
Mm-hmm.
So aside from that, the Lutzes don't really talk about what happened on that last night, but what they do say is that it was essentially everything that they needed to never go back in the house again.
Right.
So they get through. This is where the misnomer comes in, because a lot of people think that they left in the middle of the night. They didn't.
I thought
that
happened.
They got up the next morning, they shared their stories with each other, and then they called Father Ray, who was the priest who had come to the house to do the blessing.
Right.
Who was the one who was like, basically, don't go in the sewing room.
Mm-hmm.
And they explained everything to him. And according to George Lutz, Father Ray was kind of like, well, GTFO, diva. And with that, on the afternoon of January 14th, 1976, the Lutz family left the home, including most of their belongings. Like, they just kind of took what they could. They left all of the DeFeo shit in the house, and they never came back for it.
Right. I mean, I was just going to say, most of their shit sounded like it was the DeFeo shit anyway.
Yeah, so. Which, you know, may or may not have something to do with your problem.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. I definitely thought that they fled in the middle of the night, but I mean, that's because that's the picture that has been painted for us through the movies.
Thanks to the movies and the book, which we'll talk about very shortly, because even though it says based on a true story, or it doesn't even say based, it says a true story,
mm-hmm.
you know, as we know, based can mean a lot of things.
Absolutely.
So after 28 days of living at 112 Ocean Avenue, the Lutz family has abandoned it. And as George said in a 2005 interview, they did not leave the house the same family that they arrived at it. According to them, the fear that they experienced during those 28 days just completely marked them and changed them for life.
Right.
Now, after moving out of the home, they moved in with Kathy's mother temporarily while George and, you know, Kathy figured out what they wanted to do with the house. And at this point, the story gets a little bit murky.
Right.
Because some people say that, you know, one person contacted the other. Some people say that the other person contacted the other. But what we need to know is that in this time after the DeFeos leave their house, they get connected with, or I said the DeFeos, yeah. while the Lutzes are out of the house, they get connected with Ronald DeFeo Jr.'s defense lawyer.
Okay.
Yeah. So essentially during this time, they start connecting with Weber. And according to Weber, they had reached out being like, hey, we've got a really great idea for a book. You know, it's a little thing called Our Life.
Mm.
And according to the Lutz family, Weber had reached out to them and was like, hey, I've got a really good idea for, you know, a way that we could maybe connect some things together. Because the tea is supposedly around this time, there was an appeal being considered for Ronald DeFeo.
Right.
So it seems almost as if William Weber was trying to find a way to really sell the Devil Made Him Do It angle.
Shit.
Exactly.
Bingo.
But we don't exactly know who contacted who or what happened, but what we do know is that they started having meetings with each other, and allegedly at one of these meetings, over a few bottles of wine and potentially a visit from a person named Jay Anson, who was an author,
uh-huh.
the Lutz family and this lawyer concocted what we know as the Amityville Horror.
Really?
Yeah, so according to this lawyer who kind of spoke out about it years later when he had a bad business deal with George Lutz and they severed communication, they, you know, brought their experience to the table. And over the course of, you know, that definitive night, or while they were having a few bottles of wine,
right.
It turns out that Weber showed them some of the crime scene photos, and he showed them, you know, some of the reports, you know, from the DeFeo murders and things like that. And it included stuff like photos of the scene that included like the fingerprint powder mm-hmm. that the cops had placed down at the scene, which, you know, was covering the walls and looked like a greenish grayish slime almost, which according to, you know, a certain lawyer, sounds like a certain greenish gray slime that became part of the Amityville lore that wasn't part of the original reports, but very quickly became part of the story afterward. Now, I just want to acknowledge all of this probably sounds a little bit confusing. So let's just break this shit down.
Right.
You have the Lutz family who walks away from this entire situation, like regardless of who contacted who, blah, blah, blah. The Lutz family come out with this story that they have experienced this really extreme haunting at the former DeFeo house.
Right.
After they moved out of the house, what we do know is that they connected with this lawyer for a portion of time. And for a portion of time, this lawyer was working with them, holding press conferences, drumming up a lot of the hype around this story. Now, this story also just so happened to do with, you know, the murders that, you know, this guy was representing in court and all this kind of stuff. So everything is really fishy. Like, I just want to acknowledge that. And basically, 2 years after all of this stuff was happening, the lawyer kind of came out and was like, all of this is bullshit and we kind of created it all just to, you know, create a book deal and stuff like that.
Right.
Whereas the Lutz family have always hardcore moved forward saying this completely happened to us. No, we did not just start off with a bump in the night and a few creaky pipes and, you know, a house that we allegedly were not able to afford. And then, you know, sat down with the lawyer and concocted a real good ghost story that could get us out of it and make everyone a little bit of money. Like, we don't completely know exactly what happened, but we just know that they connected. The story solidified a little bit. And then after some time, there was a bad business deal that went on. George Lutz says that basically the book deal was getting established, and he found out that Ronald DeFeo Jr. was going to be making some money off the rights from the whole thing.
Ooh.
And, you know, the Lutz family was like, well, we don't want him to profit off of his murders in any kind of way, so they totally cut it off. But if you ask the lawyer, you know, it was because he thought that the Lutz family was inauthentic and all that other kind of stuff. It's just, it gets really messy at a certain point.
Yeah.
Yeah, and what we do know is that they ultimately connected, and then everything just kind of fell through. And, you know, not long after moving out of the house, the Lutz family was kind of left alone again. But because they had connected with this lawyer and done press conferences and everything like that, they had started basically a media firestorm that they could not call the end of.
Right. It was a big symphony of, huh?
Exactly. Everyone was kind of like, what the fuck? Now, the thing is, you know, they were all over the news. They were all over the papers. Everybody wanted a piece of them. And one of the people that wanted a piece of them also kind of wanted to help them. And this was somebody named Laura DiDio. Now, Laura DiDio worked for Channel 5 News in New York. They have appeared in a ton of different Amityville documentaries and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, she was a young reporter at the time who had heard about everything that was going on with the Lutz family and this house, and she could tell that they were genuinely terrified, and she really wanted to help connect them with people that could potentially assist them, not just people who wanted to get book deals and wanted to get famous off of it.
Right.
So Laura DiDio connects the Lutz family with a couple from Connecticut named Ed and Lorraine Warren.
Well, isn't that ironic?
I know. So get your hairpins out, baby, because Lorraine and Ed are on the town. So George meets with the Warrens and Laura DiDio at the house. And according to Laura, George wouldn't even go inside. He just kind of stood off on the periphery.
Sure.
But basically, Laura goes in there with the Warrens, and right away, Lorraine's spidey senses are tingling.
Mm-hmm. Those beady eyes are beating.
Yeah, she felt a very severe presence in the home right away, and this was all that she needed. So Channel 5 decided to do a full investigation, and don't you know, the investigation will be televised.
And sponsored.
Yeah, oh, definitely.
Uh-huh.
And you know the Warrens are probably getting a paycheck off of it.
Absolutely.
I mean, allegedly. That's a little bit of conjecture right there, but listen, if I know my friends the Warrens.
Yeah, they were definitely getting something.
If there's one thing they love more than demons, it's money.
They love that demon money.
They got that demon money.
Yes. All right.
So they do their investigation on March 6th of 1976. When they do this, they bring in a team of parapsychologists and the Warrens, and of course, cameras.
Yes.
Now, we're talking video, we're talking stills, we're talking cameras set up to just take streams of photos on different floors of the house. We are also talking a whole bunch of mediums just walking through the house like the worst environmental theater piece you have ever experienced.
Yeah.
Like Amateur Night at the Fringe.
Uh-huh.
Like, and I, you get what I mean.
Definitely, yeah. They're the ones that are performing in like the venue like solo, coincidentally, while Fringe is happening, and people get confused and think they're going to the Fringe, but they're not.
Yeah, like they're going for Sleep No More, and I'm just like, no, baby, sleep. Just sleep.
Yeah.
Yeah, please. All right, so Lorraine and her backing band go into the house. The cameras are there, and the psychics are wailing.
Mm-hmm.
People are feeling presences. A cameraman on the second floor bent over, clutching his chest with stabbing pains, but he didn't have a heart attack.
Right.
And Everyone was just like, I'm sure that nobody really tried to help him or anything like that. Everyone was just like, confirmation. Oh my God.
Right. Yeah. What was craft services? It was probably a lot of very fatty, very cheesy foods.
I don't even know if they would have had a craft services. I mean, they had to experience the entire house. I mean, everything had to be camera ready.
That's true. I mean, but it's an Ed and Lorraine production. You mean to tell me they didn't have at least some finger sandwiches?
I'm sure that they had like a crafty van or something like that, at least.
Yeah.
Anyway, house full of people trying to figure out what is happening in Amityville.
Right.
And at the same time, you also supposedly had some of these mediums trying to help some of the spirits pass over.
Sure.
So shit got real loud. And Lorraine was saying that she could see demons and hooded demons, like monk demons. mannequins from mm-hmm. hell that were just like floating around the home, almost just kind of like drag queens at a party, you know, just kind of like bringing a little bit of spice to the room.
Totally.
Yeah, just working the room, you know, taking shots with people, stuff like that.
Yes, yeah, and the Lorraine, paid personalities, you know?
Absolutely. And according to Lorraine, she said after being in the house that this was the closest to hell that she wishes that she ever gets.
Oh, yes, the gateway to hell. Mm-hmm, of
yeah. course. Oh, yeah, I guess that did probably kind of morph into the, that's a gateway to hell!
Yes.
Yeah, so this all happens. Ed and Lorraine walk through the home with a crucifix. They have a seance, and Ed reportedly got attacked by demons, which I guess to everybody else in the room just looked like a strong gust of wind.
Okay.
Or almost as if Ed was like reacting to a strong gust of wind. Like he just kind of like fluttered his arms and was like, whoa.
Shit.
Yeah. When those demons attack, baby, they attack. Yeah. And as Laura DiDio said, she didn't see or feel anything, but what she did experience that night was really just people's reactions.
Right. I mean, even if people were reacting authentically, it could maybe be hysteria. I don't know.
I mean, yeah. I mean, who knows? But or you mean mass hysteria.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, so the thing is, this is all on tape, but at a certain point, the camera people and the producers were just kind of like, all right, we've been having these folks just screaming and doing seances mm-hmm. for like 6 hours. Maybe we should just shut down shop.
Right. Yeah. They probably got everything they needed for their segment.
They did. But you know what? Even though not a lot came from the evening in terms of giving them like the real live TV Exorcist that they had been hoping for, because really they were hoping that it was going to be like The Exorcist live on TV.
They were hoping it was going to be Ghost Watch.
Exactly. Like OG Ghost Watch. But the thing is, even though they didn't really get anything, an iconic photo did come from that night. And you may have encountered this photo
before. I do know this photo, yes. Yeah,
so this is the one where it's a shot of the second floor landing. It shoots like through a banister and you see through a doorway the form of a person sticking out of the doorway looking back at the camera.
Mm-hmm.
This was one of the cameras that was set up just taking stills of the second floor while people were moving through the house, and nobody was on the floor in the photos before or after. They didn't see anybody going into the room. So this is really just an anomaly on film that nobody could explain.
Yes.
But that photo got out, and basically everyone was just like, that has to be Jody.
Oh,
or
shit.
One of the DeFeo boys that got killed.
That's what I always thought, because it looks kind of like a child.
Exactly. Yes. But yeah, that photo went out. That was kind of the biggest piece of pie that came out of that whole night, and the mm-hmm. rest of it just went uneaten.
Right.
Wow, that's not a metaphor, Johnny. Anyway.
It is now.
Moving forward from that, as we know, the Lutz family never returned to the house at 112 Ocean Avenue. Ultimately, the bank took possession of the home, and all of the belongings were auctioned off. Now, of course, you know, Ed and Lorraine did get in there a few more times, I do believe. Mm-hmm. You know, they did seances, and some other people did. You know, so many parapsychologists came through the Amityville home. Everyone had a theory for what was haunting them. There's some pretty problematic stuff that Ed and Lorraine started touting about indigenous people and leaders warring and graveyards being discovered that nobody's ever corroborated. So I really don't want to give that much of a stage to that bullshit.
Totally. If you want a stage for that bullshit, check out Amityville 3D. Because that movie kind of explores that. It actually stars, what's her name? Aunt Becky from Full House. She just got like arrested for fraud or whatever.
Oh, Lori Loughlin.
Yeah. She's in that film. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, good for her. Anyway, the thing that we need to know is that the Lutz family never returned. Everybody has their ideas of what exactly was haunting them, but, you know, it never really got solved.
Right.
They went on a whole bunch of programs afterward and did a whole bunch of arguing with the Warrens, with an author named Stephen Kaplan, who wrote The Amityville Conspiracy, that talked a little bit more about the lawyers' involvement in things. There were lawsuits. There was he said, she said, he said, he said. Everyone was saying something.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of where the story ends, though. Like, nothing really spooky happens after that. There have been four families that have lived in the house office at 112 Ocean Avenue, which is now 108 Ocean Avenue, none of them have ever experienced anything. In fact, all that they've ever experienced are annoying Amityville fanatics coming by the house and fucking with them.
It's true.
Yeah, like, people from the neighborhood are pretty over it. You know, like, even though I just said where it is, don't fucking go there. They don't want to deal with you. Mm-mm. If they ever do an event, I'm sure they will let everyone know. But ultimately, you know, the spooky ooky shit that happened at that house ended with the Lutzes, and that's kind of why a lot of people believe that maybe this was just a really good money-making hoax. Because Jay Anson did his book in 1977. The movie starring James Brolin and Margot Kidder came out in 1979. It has been a huge franchise ever since. Like, dig this. Here are the movies that include Amityville in the title. The Amityville Horror from 1979, Amityville 2, The Possession from 1982, Amityville 3D from 1983, Amityville 4, The Evil Escapes from 1989, Amityville Curse from 1990, Amityville It's About Time from 1992, Amityville A New Generation, isn't that Degrassi?
Yeah.
From 1993, Amityville Dollhouse from 1996, like the Ibsen play, Amityville Horror 2005 Remake, The Amityville Haunting 2011, and the Amityville Asylum from 2013, Amityville Death House from 2015, Amityville Playhouse from 2015, Amityville Vanishing Point from 2016, and Amityville Legacy from 2016. Don't forget the Amityville Terror from 2016, and we got to cap off the year of the Amityville 2016 with Amityville No Escape, which came near the end of the year. And then 2017, we saw Amityville Evil Never Dies, we saw Amityville Exorcism, we saw Amityville The Awakening, and then in 2018, we saw Amityville Mount Misery Road, the Amityville Murders, and then they took a break in 2019, because why not?
Yes.
But in 2020, we did see the release of Amityville Island.
Amityville Island.
Who knows?
What? But that's why they took the break in 2019, because they had to build the Amityville Island.
Yeah, they had to borrow Bjork's Island or something like that. Yeah, you know, I mean, an island is not built in a day.
Listen, that is a lot of movies.
Well, and I think, as you were saying when I first said that I was going to do this case, you were like, I think that is probably the cheapest rights to a horror franchise that a filmmaker can buy.
Yeah, I think the reason why you saw so many in 2016 is because something happened with the licensing or the trademarking where it became like very available, if not like totally like free, for people to make Amityville movies. So I don't think they're all affiliated.
No, but there are also a few different documentaries that have been made about it, including, as I was saying, My Amityville Horror, which is from the standpoint of one of the boys of the Lutz family. Mm-hmm. So that is quite interesting. They do kind of break down motivations in there. We will never fully know exactly what happened. If it was not true, we will also never fully understand why, you know, it was fabricated.
Right.
We can all make our assumptions, but George and Kathy Lutz both died throughout the early 2000s. Some people do assume that, you know, the Lutzes were going through financial troubles or legal troubles, but the sons have held pretty steadfast to the idea that they were not experiencing anything of that nature and that all of this stuff really truly did happen.
Okay.
But a lot of people also point out that this kind of came at a perfect time. Amityville happened on the heels of the Exorcist craze. This was pre-Satanic Panic. People were ready to be scared.
True.
And the Amityville story, as it came to be, like, regardless of what exactly happened, the story that went out there had everything. Mm-hmm. It had paranormal, it had exorcisms, it had all this stuff. So that's why it became such a huge phenomenon.
Right. And it had true crime too, because they tied in the DeFeo murders into the lore.
Exactly. So yeah, it kind of had a little bit of everything for everyone. And that's kind of been the secret to its success. It's become a very classic kind of quote American haunting, if you will.
Yes.
One of the first truly American hauntings, a lot of people say. And one of the biggest. I don't know if there ever will be a bigger haunting than the Amityville Horror.
I don't know, because even if it's not, let's say it's not real and it's all fake, I don't think you could get away with that today.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, I really don't. That's why I don't know if we ever will see something like this again. You know, it's a larger conversation to have, but Yeah, I don't know. It really was a perfect storm, and it came at a perfect time, and it gave the people what they wanted. So
totally.
That is the story of the Amityville Horror. I'm sure at some time in the future you'll be able to buy the house because it keeps going up for sale, baby.
Mm-hmm.
And the price is currently sitting around a little less than $1 million.
Ooh.
Yeah.
It's a lot more than $88,000.
Yeah, well, I mean, if your children approve the mortgage like the Lutzes, then it can be yours.
That's it, right? The Property Brothers origin story.
Yeah, truly. All right, so thank you to my sources. Thought Catalog for 112 Ocean Avenue, 17 Facts About the House That Inspired the Amityville Horror, written by Jerome London in May of 2019. Thank you to All Things Interesting for The Horrific True Story of Ronald DeFeo Jr. and the Amityville Murders, written by Aaron Kelly in October 2017. Thank you to Washington Post for The Amityville Horror House is for Sale, 5 Bedrooms, 3.5 Bathrooms, and One Bloody History, written by Lindsay Bever in June of 2016. Thank you to HistoryVersusHollywood.com for The Amityville Horror 1979, can't find the author. Thank you to Live Science for Is the Amityville Horror House Really Haunted?, written by Benjamin Radford in May of 2012.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you to AmityvilleFiles.com, the story, that was the page, which was written by Eric Walter and Blaine Duncan. Thank you to the Biography Network for The Real Amityville Horror, Chilling Facts About the Crime and Haunted House, which was written by the editors of Biography.com in October of 2019. Thank you to the documentary as well, The Real Amityville Horror from 2005, which was put out by Noblescape Productions. And thank you to the listing for the Amityville Horror House on Zillow.com, as well as the IMDb page and Wikipedia pages for most of these Amityville movies, because that's where I got the info from.
Yes.
And that's it.
Wow.
It's only a 15-page story.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I was going to commend you for making the Amityville so easy to swallow, because like you established, there's so much stuff surrounding it.
I was just afraid that I was going to be spitting out facts and that it wasn't going to get spooky. So I hope I freaked you out a little bit.
Listen, we got the spooky with the haunting, and then it just got scary in a real way after all of that.
I know,
all
right?
Of that, like, legal stuff and Lorraine Warren.
Well,
yeah.
That's the thing. And I had like 5 pages of just, you know, like, oh, so-and-so threatened a lawsuit to so-and-so. And it's like, nobody gives a fuck about that, Brenda.
Mm-hmm.
They give a fuck about the spooky stuff. And you just have to know that everybody fought about it afterward, but it didn't matter because the ghost story had gotten famous.
Exactly. And I am thankful for that ghost story, because the Amityville Horror, I remember as a kid learning about it, seeing clips of it on television. It really ignited my love for spooky shit.
That's the point with so much of this. It's like, even if it's not real, at this point, 50 years later, I don't give a fuck. You know what I give a fuck about? This fun, spooky, ooky, kind of campfire-ish story.
Totally.
Because, yeah, it's, you know, it's our... folklore has to come from somewhere, baby.
Right.
Maybe someday they'll be talking about Amityville and it'll become a lost story. Oh, I can't wait until the day that Amityville becomes a lost story.
Right.
Anyway, so that is my topic for the week. Now, before we get into your topic, we wanted to take a little moment to talk about something at the beginning of the show, and we forgot about it. So maybe we should just take a moment to break it down now. We never really do this, but if anything, consider this like a mid-roll ad.
Yeah.
So we talked about this on Instagram recently. We haven't really brought it up on the show yet, but June was a pretty rough month for the Secret Society in terms of, you know, membership drop off because the world is on fire.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've heard about that yet, but like, we totally understand, but we just wanted to shine a little spotlight on the Secret Society and say that if anybody who has not joined could join, it would be really appreciated, and it would actually really help us, you know, keep the lights on over here, very literally speaking.
Totally.
Yeah, and you know, like, I feel like we bring it up a lot as like a, oh, you know, hey, get something for yourself, get a mini episode, get a stream. Like, we make it into a product a lot, but I just kind of want to underline the fact that it also is our stream of income right now in these COVID times.
Well, totally. It's kind of the, and the Patreon is really what supports the podcast at this point. We're kind of like PBS, honey.
Yeah.
This is listener support.
Yeah, we don't have ads at this point. We don't have sponsors at this point. Like, that may change in the future and that will be great, but for now, like, we're just dipping it and doing it. So if you can throw a few bucks on there, it would be super appreciated. And yeah, like we always say, you'll get the bang for your buck.
Definitely. Yeah. And we've got lots of tiers. You can pick the tier that works for you. And I also do want to just extend a thank you for everybody who has joined the
Absolutely.
Secret Society this month, because we've seen a lot of people come forward and help us out. And we just really fucking appreciate it. Can I just put a fucking in there to Absolutely. Highlight how much we appreciate
Please
that?
Do.
Yes.
And also, I just want to say, like, everything that I just said, that is not me saying that if you were part of the Secret Society, please up your pledge, or if you've had to leave the society, please come back. None of that. But who I'm speaking to are the thousands of people who listen to the show that aren't part of the society. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just a sheer fact that, you know, like, they're the I'm not going to give you the numbers, but it's healthily in the thousands, and the Secret Society membership is currently a little under 200.
Right.
So, you know, like, there's room to grow, and we're not forcing it down on anyone. We understand the world is on fire as much as anybody
right, right. now. A lot of people have lost their jobs. Yeah. A lot of people are short on income.
Yeah.
It's totally understandable.
But we just wanted to take a little moment to, you know, underline the importance of it during these times.
Yes.
Anyway, thank you.
Thank you. Now back to the show.
Except we never left.
No, we're still here, and it's All my right. turn.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So what do you have?
All right. So what I have for us today is a goddamn treat.
Really?
I'll tell you that. Today, I'm going to be talking about the Solvathelam on my murders.
Okay.
Now, I will say, we're going to India. So there are going to be a lot of words, a lot of names, and a lot of places that I'm probably not going to pronounce correctly, including this one, Solvathelam on my murders.
But you've been looking up the pronunciations. We should make that distinction.
We should make that distinction.
You're not just going in cold, being like, I wonder what these words are.
No, if you look at my notes, every single name that I will have an issue with is highlighted. And I should say that the Solvathelam Unmai is the name of a television show. And for that, I couldn't actually get any pronunciation for it, because in English it basically means whatever said is the truth, or tell the truth, okay. something like that. And I guess that just brings us straight into the story. So this is a television show from India. In 2012, the show was in its second year on the air, and a new episode was broadcast every Monday to Friday. It was actually a lot like the American daily talk shows that we're familiar with, like Maury or Sally Jesse Raphael
or
Jenny Jones. Mm-hmm. Exactly. It was of that ilk. So this show, Whatever Said Is the Truth, was marketed as a reality justice show that aired in the Indian state of Tamil.
Not a reality justice show.
That's how they Ooh. Described it.
Oh my God. All right.
But I mean, when you hear reality justice show, you'd probably think something more like Judge Judy. And it was kind of that, but it was everything. It was the whole shebang.
Okay.
Uh-huh. So this show had been hosted by a few different people during its run from 2011 to 2018. But in 2012, the show still had its original host, Nirmala Pariyasamy. Now, oftentimes the show would have families or friends on to try and resolve any manner of quarrels. The themes of the show were never anything out of the ordinary for a TV show like this. It would be about like fights over infidelity, people secretly married to multiple spouses.
It sounds like a great place for all those Amityville people to go to fight about whether it was real or it wasn't.
Sure. Yeah, they would have had a lot of room for them too, because the stage has two long couches for all their guests to sit on. So they're ready for a row.
Sounds like a
party.
You
know what I mean? Yeah. Uh-huh. Now, unfortunately, I don't think they ever had any episodes where people were like afraid of pickles or mustard. Did you remember that from Maury?
Oh yeah.
That was like the most iconic. There's also God. A woman afraid of kittens.
Yeah. Yeah. That shit defines a generation. I can't forget about that.
It really does.
No.
But this show didn't really feature that. Regardless of what topics were being covered, though, episodes of Whatever Said Is the Truth would usually end with some sort of resolution. But during a two-part episode, which aired on May 28th and May 29th in 2012, things went a little bit south.
Okay.
Actually, things got real wild. So, a 17-year-old girl or woman named Bhargavi and her 21-year-old husband, Satish Kumar, had eloped a month prior to filming this episode.
Ooh.
And they did so unbeknownst to Bhargavi's parents.
Oh, mm-hmm. Okay.
Scandal.
Heating up.
Yes.
I'm just glad that we're not going down a road of like Scott Amador, Jenny Jones. I thought we were about to do a gay panic case or something.
Not quite.
That's a relief.
Yeah. So Bhargavi and Satish reached out to the show because they wanted to come clean to Bhargavi's parents about their elopement. The couple was screened, interviewed, and they were approved for the show. So once they were approved for the show, they had to reach out to Bhargavi's parents to get them on the show. So they reached out to her father, Murugan, and mother, Rajeswari, and they were invited onto the show by their daughter, but the reasoning for their appearance on the show would not be revealed until they were brought in to film for the show.
Of course, that's right. The drama.
That's it. We need that drama. So the episode about Bhargavi and Satish's secret marriage aired like it always did, live on the Zee Tamil television network. But this episode was going to be different in a very big way. So the episode began with Bhargavi and Satish sitting on one side of the studio being interviewed by Nirmala. And the set is very much like a welcome to my office. It's like very... very corporate looking,
okay,
for lack of a better word.
Very like neutral furniture, fake plants, yes. Everything's very just evenly lit.
Totally, yeah. Like laminate floor. And then the host, Nirmala, is sitting in a chair and surrounded by the couches with the guests.
I'm into it.
Yes, exactly. So at the top of the show, Nirmala is sitting there with Bhargavi and Satish, and they're basically just talking about their whole experience. They got eloped, blah, 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 blah.
Yep.
Halfway through the episode, Bhargavi's parents are brought onto the set, and they're sat across from their daughter on the opposite side of the studio with Nirmala moderating between them. Now, on camera, Bhargavi explained to her parents for the first time that she and her 21-year-old husband, Satish, had eloped 1 month ago. So Nirmala pressed forward with the interview and asked the girl to explain why she had kept her marriage a secret from her parents. And Bhargavi's explanation was pretty simple. She kept her marriage a secret because her parents did not approve of her relationship. They had wanted her to marry somebody else, but she was in love, so she chose to move away from her home to live with Satish and his parents in the Vilayapuram municipality.
I mean, why not? I'm all for couples eloping, even if shit's good with the family. My sister did that, and my mother was never more proud of her.
Right.
She was like, yeah, you go have your wedding in the Dominican Republic.
Listen, it's very economical as well.
Yeah. I mean, maybe my family's a little bit of a different case because I'm the youngest of six. So my mom was like, don't worry, I've got another one to pick from. You're fine.
Yeah, exactly. You're not the one child with the pressure to have all of the, like, ceremonies around.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of evenly distributed.
Exactly. But that wasn't the case for Bhargavi because I believe that she was an only child. So the heat was on.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the municipality where Bhargavi and Satish were staying was still within Tamil, and Tamil is a state in India, but it was a respectable distance away from where her parents lived, and her parents lived in Nalan Piliai Petrol Village. So unfortunately for Bhargavi, her parents did not take the news of her elopement very well. Nirmala tried to interject and steer the conversation when she could, but a majority of the program consisted of Bhargavi and her parents fighting.
Damn.
Now, it gets more. Satish's parents were brought in, and that just ignited a whole new storm of fighting. So it was just very Jerry Springer at this point in time.
Yeah.
And it actually went into a second day. So they weren't able to resolve everything on the first day. So they brought everybody back for a second day so that they could hopefully get a satisfactory resolution to the show. Now, as the episode crept towards its end time on the second day, Nirmala made a last-ditch effort to control the conversation by suggesting that the family should all make amends and that Bhargavi, alone or with her husband, should go home with her parents to work things out together.
Oh, basically being like, too much bullshit. We got drag queens coming in on Thursday. We don't have enough episodes to give you guys resolution.
Exactly. And I mean, she was also a 17-year-old teenager at this point, so I'm sure they weren't taking anything that she was saying very seriously.
Fair.
But then she started to panic. Bhargavi told Nirmala that going home would not be an option for herself and Satish. And Nirmala pressed on, asking for more details. And that's when Bhargavi began to confess the secrets that she knew.
Okay.
So very calmly, Bhargavi stated that she couldn't move back into her parents' home because she feared that her father would kill them.
Damn!
On live television.
Like, he's actually going to kill them, or like, my dad's gonna kill me.
Right. Well, I think at first they kind of took it in that way of like, oh, my dad's gonna kill me. Like, I bumped his car. Or like, mm-hmm. oh, I took Nona to the strip club. My parents are gonna kill me.
Yeah, dad notices that I took 10 bucks out of his wallet.
Exactly. Yeah. That kind of thing. So
don't
I think
steal
that's
from
what...
your parents, by the way.
No, don't so, do it.
Don't. Unless your parents are racist, and then steal from your parents, then whatever.
Yeah.
Just nothing too horrible, you know? Like, 10 bucks, that's fine.
Exactly.
From a racist, yeah.
Yes, steal from racists, that's
parents,
okay.
Parents, yeah, but not, like, at your job or anything. Don't get fired.
No, yeah, look out for you,
yeah.
honey.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So, anyway, back to this story. So, Bhargavi is basically just like, oh, I can't go home, my parents are going to kill me. And nobody took it very seriously, but then she went on. For her... this was serious business because she then revealed that her father had already killed 3 people
what?
And buried them in her family's garden 4 years ago when she was just 13 years
Holy
old.
Holy fuck. No, so she's not even like, oh, my dad killed people in the army. He can do any-. It's like, no, like my dad killed people and buried them in the backyard?
Yeah. So everybody in the studio was shook.
Yeah.
Nirmala was shook. The entire state of Tamil, who is watching from home, was shook.
Roll credits.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But wait, that's not all. Because when Bhargavi drops this Lauren Dern digging around in dinosaur poop-sized truth bomb, her mother, Rajeswari, backed up the claim.
Whoa.
Uh-huh.
Damn.
The broadcast came to an end shortly after that, with footage of Bhargavi and her father arguing, followed by some really awkward footage of all the families kind of like half-heartedly hugging.
What?
Because this was also the MO of the show, apparently. I mean, I've never seen it, but like they really wanted the shows to come to some kind of like positive resolution.
It's like a fucking Mad TV sketch. Like, where do you go after? My dad killed 3 people and they're buried in the backyard.
Exactly.
Like that escalated quickly.
Uh-huh. So the drama had concluded in the broadcast world, but the drama behind the scenes was just getting started.
Yeah.
So Bhargavi's father, Murugan, was furious. He was incredibly upset with his daughter for making such a bold-faced claim against him on live television, and he was equally upset at his wife for backing up the claim.
Oh, yeah, because I guess if he didn't actually do it, like, that is quite a statement.
Right, that's some slander, and that is a bold accusation.
Yeah, diva.
But at this point, the claims that were made on air were really just that. They were just accusations, so there was nothing that anybody could do other than just be like, what?
Sit there, mouth agape, yeah.
Exactly. So Murugan couldn't be detained, and he was free to take the bus back home with his wife. Now, unsurprisingly, Bhargavi did not follow her parents back to their home, as Nirmala had suggested. Instead, she chose to continue living with her husband's family.
Fair.
Now, the bus ride home for Murugan and Rajeswari was looking like a long one. Because, you know, sharing a bus with somebody who just accused you of triple homicide on live TV would be probably pretty bad. But it would be also equally as bad if you had to take a bus ride back home with the person who you just accused for committing triple homicide, especially if they did commit triple homicide.
Absolutely.
Right? It's not a good situation.
Well, yeah, because, and it's not even like she came out with the claim, but she backed it up, so she didn't say anything.
Right.
So, yeah, that is like the worst couples argument ever.
Absolutely. And speaking of couples arguments, apparently Murugan spent the majority of the bus ride verbally assaulting Rajeswari with insults, threats, and other defamatory comments. But about halfway through the bus ride, he decided to get up and go, literally. So during one of the bus's routine stops, Murugan got out of his chair, turned to Rajeswari, and said that she would never see him alive ever again before stepping off the bus and abandoning her.
Oh, fuck. So his wife's just kind of sitting there being like, well, time to go home.
Yeah.
Like, where do you go after that, too? Fuck.
Right? I mean, literally just home.
That's terrifying. Yeah. Poor her. And I mean, she didn't even want to go on this. Like, especially like the mother, like, I feel really bad for her right now. She's caught in the middle.
Right? Definitely. Yeah. Her daughter is afraid to go home. And I mean, is
and
also,
she's the one that has to. Yeah.
And she's the one that has to. Exactly. So it's not a great situation for her.
Yeah. Well, absolutely or not. In her mind, she has to. She doesn't have to. Nobody has to do anything. Just to. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Good point.
Just a little autonomy for your nerve.
Right. Now, while Murugan was Murugan and Rajeswari was just on the bus on her way back home, thank you so much. The Z Network, the show, the network where the show was broadcast, had been in touch with local authorities who agreed to look into the matter. So they were basically just like, hey, yo, police, this just happened. You probably saw it. It was live on TV. Everybody was watching.
Yeah.
But this is a pretty bold claim. Maybe you want to look into it. And the authorities agreed, like, yeah, maybe we should look into it. So, of course, no one wanted to believe that these accusations were true. Hopefully, it was just a bit of exploitative television programming. But they did have a name and they did have an address. So it would be easy enough to verify if there was any truth to these accusations. So there was communication with the authorities in Nalam Pillali Patral village, and they managed to gain access to Murugan and Rajaswari's home before their return, thanks to the help of their landlord.
Yes.
So Miss Landlord had seen the broadcast on television and was already well aware of what was going on with her property. So when the authorities reached out, she was like, yes, let's do this.
Absolutely.
So the authorities searched the property for any sign of foul play, but everything seemed normal. Everything seemed great until they started picking around in the backyard. Authorities scanned the perimeter of the yard for more clues, and then some of them began to dig around in the garden. And that's when they found something strange and uncomfortably familiar, and alti, something they kind of thought they were going to find.
Oh.
A human skull.
Of course.
Buried in the garden.
I'm glad you weren't like, a wig collection.
Right, yeah. No.
Drag that he's been hiding from the family because he doesn't want anyone to know that he's the diva yet.
Right. Don't bury it. If you're hiding your drag, don't bury it in a garden.
No.
Put it in the basement with your furs.
I'm just thinking about that one queen in, like, it was that season 3 casting special that they did on RuPaul's Drag Race, where they're like, I keep my drag underneath my house.
Oh,
like,
really?
In, like, a weird little crawl space. Yeah, it was a queen that kind of looked like the princess.
Oh, my God.
I just always remember being like, is that by choice or is that due to space? What is up with that?
Right. How many bodies are there as well?
Exactly. Yeah. Do the bodies keep the drag warm?
Right.
Yeah.
Probably. Or is it the other way around? Does the drag keep the bodies warm?
There you go.
So they dug around in the garden. They found a skull. So obviously at this point, there was a full-on excavation of the property and a ton of bones were collected. A medical professional quickly determined that the collective pile of bones belonged to at least 3 different people. So it was very clear that Bhargavi and Rajaswari had stayed true to the television show inherent intent and told the truth.
Diva, yeah, they did. They need like a medal for that one.
They do. But the thing is, this wasn't over because the problem was the authorities still needed to make an arrest. So Rajaswari had already returned home and she was by herself. The authorities had been there to greet her and took her into custody.
She's like, no surprise there.
Right.
She's rolling into the house.
Totally. Yeah. So based on the televised accusations, authorities didn't really believe that she had been responsible for the bodies in her garden, but they did believe that she knew exactly what had happened. Luckily, she was more than willing to spill the beans and pinned it all on her husband, Murugan. So first of all, she said she was able to identify the skeletal remains as a Sakar, his daughter Lavanya, and her boyfriend Salambarasan. And
ooh,
they were their next door neighbors.
Okay.
Well,
were.
4 years ago.
Yeah.
When police cross-referenced the names with their database, they quickly discovered that there were missing persons reports for all of these people that were filed by Sakar's wife about 4 years prior in 2008. So it was very obvious that they had been murdered by Murugan, but what they still didn't know was why or how, and the only person who could answer those questions was Murugan himself. The problem was, he was still missing out for a run.
Oh, yeah.
Or out on the run.
Yeah. Just dancing around.
Just dancing around.
Yeah.
So the hunt for Murugan ensued. The police started by questioning nearby friends and family and acquaintances, and then they branched out to other parts of Tamil, following any lead they could. 2 days into their search, police got tipped off that Murugan was hiding out at a friend's house in the Vilapuram municipality, which was the same municipality where his daughter, Bhargavi, was living with her husband's family.
Oh, shit. So do they think that maybe he was, like, on his way to her?
I mean, maybe.
Oh, that's so Tiger King.
Very that.
Yeah.
So, aware of his whereabouts, officers disguised themselves as a television crew.
Oh,
and they tracked him down. they invited him onto their television program, selling it as an opportunity for him to set the record straight.
Of course, and his tiny little ego just couldn't help but take the bait.
Actually, yeah, if that was me, obviously he knew that he did this. Mm-hmm. And obviously he knew that pretty much everybody else knew that he had done this. So what part of his brain would be like, hey, this is a great idea. I should go back on television and readdress
it's this the ego scenario. That outweighs the intellect.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. So obviously when he agreed to go on this television program, he was arrested promptly and taken back for questioning.
Good. Joke's on you.
Yeah. So Murugan was taken back to his village, and there he was interrogated by the police. Realizing that the gig was up, Murugan pleaded guilty to the murders and went on to explain what he had done and why he had done it, the last missing piece of the puzzle.
All right.
So according to him, he had murdered Asakar, his daughter Lavanya, and her boyfriend Silim Barasan after a dispute over their family jewels. Not his family jewels, not Murugan's family jewels.
And not like testicles?
No, like literal gold.
Okay.
Yeah.
Not as interesting, but okay.
Totally. And as I've established, Asakar lived next door with his family. And it's hard to say what their relationship was like as neighbors, but presumably the families got along well enough for Asakar and his daughter to ask Murugan to look after their family jewelry, most of which belonged to Lavanya.
Okay.
I'm not really sure why you would ask a neighbor to hold on to all of your gold.
I don't know. Maybe like somebody's targeting you. Maybe you're going somewhere and you don't know when exactly you'll be back. Maybe they just have a really good safe. Maybe they have more storage than you. I mean, it can be a whole bunch of different things.
It's true. But for that, whatever the reason was, we're not really sure. The point was Murugan now had their gold jewelry. And once he had it, he decided that he wanted to keep it for himself.
Of course.
And so one day, he invited Lavanya and her boyfriend over for dinner. Murugan had gotten the couple incredibly drunk, like super wasted, and then served them each a plate of food for dinner. Thing was, unbeknownst to them, the dinner was poisoned, and the couple dropped dead shortly thereafter. Now, allegedly, Murugan's wife and his brother were there at the time, but they weren't privy to what was going on before it was too late. So this was all premeditated by Murugan, but he didn't share his premeditation with anybody.
Okay, but then, like, the moment after, like, that, what happens then?
Well, that's it. I'm not really sure. They're not really sure if they helped him dispose of the bodies, or if he did it on his own.
Or if they were just like, oh, they died. All right, well, I'm going to bed. You deal with this. We'll talk to you later, okay?
Totally, yeah. And there's some vague details to this case, and we'll talk about why those details might be a little bit vague at the end. But the point was, the young neighbor and her boyfriend were dead. And with two dead bodies on his hand, Murugan set forth to dispose of the bodies in the cloak of night, digging a shallow grave for both of them in the garden out back.
Okay.
Now, the next day, Lavanya's dad, Asakar, comes over to Murugan's home to ask about the whereabouts of his daughter and his boyfriend. He knew that Murugan had them over for dinner the night before, and so he thought that maybe he could help him find them. And Murugan did, in a way, by giving Asakar the same dose of lethal hospitality.
Oh, of course.
He got him super drunk and then fed him a bunch of poisoned food. He was dead, and then he got buried in the garden outback.
Oh my God. Okay, if you ever go to approach somebody because somebody in your life is missing, and that person is like, let me fix you a drink, be suspicious.
Totally.
Right away.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What you say is, thank you. I'll mix my own drink if you don't mind.
Thank you. And then just start writing on a little reporter's notepad that you keep in your breast pocket.
True. Yeah. Yes.
Put them on edge.
You should always have an in case I murder note hidden somewhere on your body.
Yeah. But also just to like really unnerve them. Like have them thinking that you're onto them right away.
Ooh, yeah, that's
good. It's a great way to make friends. Always write into a reporter notebook that you keep in your front pocket.
Totally. Yeah. I feel like those are maybe the tactics that Jeffree Star takes.
Yeah, totally. He like goes on public transit and then he just like stares a hole through people, sometimes giving the bird eye, which I explained in Queens of the North. So crossover, listen to that if you want to know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
But yeah, and then he whips out his reporter notebook and just starts writing about the people that he's staring at, or just like feverishly writing, and then he like puts it away and then keeps staring at them, so they think that he's writing notes about them. It's fucking psychological warfare, you know?
It really is.
I think a lot about these things.
I mean, it's kind of wild.
Yeah.
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 But speaking of psychological warfare, or I guess just like warfare, or I guess just like plain as day murder.
Yeah, welcome to my fucking head.
Uh-huh. Murugan had just buried three bodies in his backyard, and now he had a bunch of gold. I'm not sure if he sold the gold. I'm not sure if he just kind of sat on it, saving it for a rainy day, but life more or less just went ahead as normal.
I just see a scene from Goldmember unfurling in front of my very eyes.
Listen, yeah, yes. Yeah.
He loves it.
So a short while later, after these three people went missing, a missing persons report was filed, and the three remained missing until that fateful day when Murugan's daughter would out him as a murderer on live television.
I love that.
Now, I couldn't find any information beyond Murugan's confession and what had happened after, surprisingly. Presumably, he was sentenced to life in prison. I've also read reports that suggest that his wife and brother were also arrested, but it seems like reporting more or less just stopped after June 8th, 2012.
They're just kind of like, we got him, that's all you need to know.
Kind of. Now, I will say there are also a lot of mixed reporting going on with this case if you decide to look it up. Some reports suggest that Murugan was having an affair with his neighbor's daughter-in-law, and that was also a part of the motivation of the murder. But that, more or less, from what I could tell, isn't really the tea.
People think that it has more to do with the gold.
Yeah, exactly. All motivated by gold.
All gold, all shade.
And some reports also say that he killed her husband and father-in-law and then held her captive for a few days. Also, I don't think that's true. I've also seen Bhargavi being referred to by another name, Parvaki, but I don't believe that's correct either. But all of these are challenges we face when we read about news that's not widely reported on internationally. Mm-hmm. We're kind of relying on a few reporters to translate it into English, if that's the only language that you speak.
Yeah, and also sometimes when you're dealing with international news, you're dealing with the laws that they have around reporting, where you're not allowed to give away certain details, or after certain points, you know, the reporting just kind of stops, and that's the trend.
Totally, yeah. And I think that's even the case with Bhargavi. They never give her a last name, and I think it's because she was 17 years old.
Yeah.
They really, and maybe the name that they've reported on isn't even her real name.
Well, and look, you can watch the TV clip you were saying, so I mean, that's enough. You don't need to know her name.
Exactly.
You don't need to Facebook her.
Yeah, give her a piece.
Yeah.
And as you said, with international laws, sometimes it's very different. So I did do some basic research into the justice system in India, and apparently it moves super duper slow, like even slower than it does here in North America, which already moves pretty slow. So it's very possible that Murugan hasn't even been convicted yet. He's definitely in jail and he'll probably be there forever, but it's not uncommon for prisoners in India to live out most of their prison sentence before their trial even starts or concludes.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh. Yeah, that could explain it then.
So that could explain the drop off on reporting as well. But Mama, that is the wild story of the Solvethalam Unmaye murders. And if you think that's all India has to offer in regards to televised murder confessions and accusations, you would be absolutely wrong. Because apparently in January 2020, a man got in a local news channel during a live broadcast and confessed to murdering his girlfriend.
What? Uh-huh. Oh my god, can we talk about that someday?
I think we absolutely will.
Yeah, maybe like spooky snacks, if anything.
Totally, yeah. It just happened this year, so I don't know how much more information there is beyond that, but that to me is just whoa.
Oh, that's high camp.
Totally.
All right.
And with that, let me thank my sources. Thank you to dailymail.com.uk for their article, My Father is a Triple Murderer, Teenager Startling Omission During a Live Chat Show Interview About Eloping with Her Boyfriend, which was written by Richard Shear on June 7th, 2012.
They always have the longest titles.
They really do. Thank you to digitaljournal.com for their article, Man Arrested After Daughter Accuses Him of Murder on Live TV. That was written by John Thomas Didymus from June 8th, 2012. Thank you to esselnewsletter.com for their article, Z Tamil's Program Helps Solve a Triple Murder Mystery. And that was written by Prakash Shestri from June 7th, 2012. Thank you to travel.gc.ca for an overview of the criminal law systems. And thank you as well to the actual program, Sylvatheum Unmai. I'm sorry, I'm hacking that up, but that episode is available on YouTube. I did check it out. As I said, there's no English translation, so it wasn't a lot of help in my particular case, but you can go get a feel for who these people are just by observing them.
Damn, well, thank you, Tyler.
Absolutely.
Oh my God, I never heard of that one before.
Right?
All right, well, this has been a long one, so we are just going to breeze through this next little bit, but we do have some business to take care of.
Yes, we do.
So let's get into it. Tyler, you know what part of the show this is. We're going to ask some hard-hitting questions. I want to know, what did you learn today?
Today I learned that if you think you know something, even if you've studied it at length in the past and you haven't revisited it in a while, go back and revisit it, because even though I'm very familiar with Amityville, listening to you retell it today, I've learned some details that I wasn't familiar with, or that I just simply didn't remember.
Oh yeah, it's true. You're never as smart as you think you are.
It's true.
Always good to double check.
That's right.
All right, I love that. All right, well, today I learned that if you are going to go, it's like Alyssa Edwards said, if you're going to be a baddie, baddie bitch, then stand up and be one. If you are going to be killing people in front of people and then expecting them to not tell people,
right?
And then you're going to be King Douche Baby about it all, and you're going to be like acting however you want to be acting, exerting as much control. No, nobody is infallible like that. Mm-mm. You can't act like that.
That's right.
Yeah, you can't just tramp all over a situation and expect people to uplift you.
Right.
And to cover for you. It's stupid.
Yes.
You're stupid. I don't like using that word. I usually try to say less than smart, but if you are killing people and then all that, you're stupid.
Yeah.
That word is reserved for you. That's exactly what I learned today.
I love
it's
that.
It's kind of two things.
Yeah.
All right. So that is what we learned today. Now, Tyler, I know that you have a review.
I do.
I know that you want to read it.
I do.
So do you mind sharing with the class?
Absolutely.
All right.
So today, class, we have a 5-star review from Crowfoot via Apple Podcasts, and they are located in the United States of America. And they say, who knew? Did I expect to burst into tears listening to a podcast that opens with a theme song that sounds like it's played with underarm farts?
The Goblin Gal.
Nope. But that's the kind of surprises I've come to expect from the hosts of this podcast. The tears were the results of learning about the heroic Willem Arondis, the LGBTQ Dutch artist / resistance fighter. Don't worry, this podcast is not a bummer. It's full of interesting facts, spookiness, and laughs. What a wonderful find.
Aww.
Oh, thank you, Crowfoot. You're a wonderful find.
You are a wonderful find. And the theme song sound isn't underarm farts. It's actually bird sounds.
It is.
Yeah. Yes. People ask that.
They do.
We get that question. And it usually has varying degrees of politeness.
Yeah.
And my response usually depends on that degree of politeness in which you come at me from.
Right.
See, what our friend here just did is perfectly right. You make it fun. You make it cheeky. That's the thing about you being shady, if you want to be a little bit shady. As long as it's fun, people love it.
Exactly.
One time somebody came at us and was like, your theme song sucks, just so you know. What are you doing with that? And it was like, oh, diva. Like, okay. Yeah. All right. Work.
Totally. But do you know who does love the theme song that you composed?
Ooh.
Little kids.
Oh, yeah. They do, man. And look, truth from the mouth of babes.
It's true.
If it slaps, it slaps. If that little thing that can't even string together a sentence wants to shake its butt to it, then it's valid to someone, baby.
It's absolutely
And that's
true.
The best review you can get, aside from Crowfoot's review, because that was a really nice one too.
Absolutely.
So thank you. All thank right. You. Well, and if you want to be just like Crowfoot and you want to leave us a 5-star rating and a review on whatever podcast app you're listening to us on, you can, and it would really help the show.
Absolutely. We love it when you send us a review. You can send it to us. You can email it to us. If you don't have Apple Podcasts.
Yeah, if you're listening to us on Spotify or another hateful app that doesn't like to include reviews, please do it on there. We'll read it on the show. And if you're looking for another way to support the show, like we were saying between the stories today, please join the Secret Society That Doesn't Suck at patreon.com/thatsspooky. It would really help us out. And of course, you get mini episodes every week with it. That's 2 episodes of That Spooky every week that you get, this free one and the Secret Society everybody wants. So, like, don't say we don't love you.
Yeah, get into it, stupid. Yeah,
diva.
And speaking of getting into it, get into our social media. We are on Twitter. We are on Instagram at ThatSpookyPod. And we've kind of reinvigorated our Facebook page. So you can also check us out there, too.
Yeah, no. And it's going to be cooking a little bit more in the future. So keep an eye out on that. And, yeah, you can also email us at ThatSpookyPod@gmail.com. That's ThatSpookyPod@gmail.com, spelled just like it is in the social media. There you can send us your freaky shit, stuff that's happened to you, stuff that's happened into your hometown, and of course, pet photos.
We love pet photos. We fucking
love them.
And then don't forget to check out our website. It's thatspooky.com. You can basically get access to everything we just talked about. It's your one-stop shop for everything that's spooky. Yes, I said chop, not stop. I meant to say stop, but I did say chop.
No, he totally meant to say chop. That's exactly what he meant to say, and he will never take it back.
Right.
And you can also go to thatspooky.com/store. And you can get yourself an enamel pin. It's a great accessory. It's the hottest thing for this summer. This
yeah.
Hellfire inferno of a summer.
Listen.
I'm so warm right now. Okay. So, everyone, thank you so much for joining us this week. It was super fun. I feel like we finally did Amityville. We finally crossed some territory that we've been meaning to cross for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So, here we are.
We did it.
A notch out of the bedpost. We did another Icon Equine, baby.
Yes.
And yeah, we will see you next week.
Yes,
with
we will.
More Icon Eek stories to share.
Get ready.
And if you're part of the society, you'll see us later on this week. Or if you're listening to Queens of the North, you'll hear from us on Saturday.
Oh, yes.
So don't forget, you're all beautiful. You're perfect just the way you are. And you'll keep on being beautiful until the day the sun stops shining.
That's right.
You're That's the... so sweet of me. You should put that on a greeting card or something.
You really should.
All right. Well, until next time, kissy kisses. And as always, if you're going to be a bitch,
be a spooky bitch.
Bye. Bye.